All right, this quarter, of course, we have three memory passages that, you know, being the gracious and kind and merciful teacher that I am, I'm allowing you to read them. But they are, of course, you can find the first one is in Exodus, lessons 1 through 4, then obviously the next 5 through 8, and then 9 through 12. Let's say them together. Exodus 13, 3. And Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place." God delivered them. Now, the next one, Exodus 19:5, is where we are today, and this is so critical. "Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine." And finally, Exodus 40, verse 34, "Then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." And when we come where we are right now at Exodus 19, we've come to a really critical part of the book of Exodus, a critical stage in God's plan of development of his scheme of redemption. The book of Exodus, as it's been divided, has 40 chapters. They almost got the chapters right in the middle. The first 18 chapters of the book, roughly the first half, focuses on the deliverance of the oppressed people, the bringing them out of bondage. The second half of the book is going to focus on Israel as the covenant people of God. And what we have really here at Mount Sinai is this great family is truly being transformed into a nation, becoming a nation of people. That was God's promise. Remember to Abraham? "I will make of you a great nation." You know, we'll look at the land part later. But here is God has taken the descendants of Abraham, and, you know, one of the great stories of Genesis, and really throughout the whole Bible, is God works on his timetable. He tells Abraham, "I'll make of you a great nation," and he goes 25 years before the promised child is born. Isaac would be 60 before he would have children. And, you know, sometimes it's many years. And they were in bondage for a period of time. But now they've come out and they are going to be God's special people, that holy nation. Just reminding ourselves, you know, these are real people in real places. And many of the locations of Exodus, you couldn't go there and say, "I know with certainty that it was exactly at this spot that they camped at Rephidim." But you can go and you can see the Red Sea. You can go and you can know that this is the land of Goshen, up here in what's called Lower Egypt, the Delta region of the Nile. And we can know that in general, this is their direction. They've come down here. And let's just think about real quickly, what are some of the hardships they'd faced along the way as they left Egypt and went toward Mount Sinai? What was the very first great obstacle they faced? The Red Sea. You know, the Pharaoh changed his mind, is coming after them, and they're surrounded. You've got wilderness, you've got water, and you've got an army. Well, where do you turn? Well, you should turn to the Lord. And the Lord parted the Red Sea for them. They get across the Red Sea. And, you know, we think about basic necessities of life. What are the first two things that come to mind? Food and water. You know, and, you know, there's no, well, they come to water, but it's bitter. God fixes that problem for them. They've run out of food. So what does God do? He gives them the manna. You know, on a daily basis, they are being fed by God. Think about this. every day they wake up to a miracle of God's providing for them. Except on the Sabbath day. And on the Sabbath day, they witness another miracle. Because the other days of the week, if they had kept their manna from the night before, it would be rotted and have worms. But they can get up on the Sabbath and it's all good. They also, let's not ever lose sight of the fact, there's another miracle they're witnessing. How did they know which route to take and where to camp? The cloud, the pillar of cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night, that God was always leading them. You know, I will reiterate, food and water are necessities of life. It is understandable that they were concerned when they had no water, when they had no food. But where they were at any given moment was exactly where God had led them to be. So they should have had faith that God would provide. And they failed in that. Miserably failed in that. And so, you know, but God's providing. Well, they've come to chapter 19. And we saw in the 18th chapter a little bit of organization to the people. And when do they get here to Mount Sinai? It says, you know, if you look at my translation, says in the third month. Some translations are going to say 3 months. There's a little ambiguity as to whether it means it was 3 months. Some think the Hebrew could mean 3 months to the day after they left Egypt. Or in the third month, meaning it's more than 2 months, but you know, you haven't quite finished the third month. Makes no real difference. They haven't been gone that long, but they come and they're camping before the mountain. In verses 3 through 6, this is a key to the book of Exodus. You know, the Passover, you know, we look at the plagues, all the plagues, we want to remember all of them. Each one played its role. But you come out of the Exodus, you remember the Passover. That's the lasting memorial. That's the figure of Jesus who would be our Passover lamb. Look at Exodus 19, 3 through 6. And if you're familiar with 1 Peter, this language will seem a little familiar there. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." One of the things to kind of watch for in this study at Mount Sinai is Moses' location up and down the mountain. This 80-year-old man goes on a lot of hiking trips. You know, God calls him on the mountain and speaks with him. He comes back to the people. He's back up on the mountain. There's a lot of up and down. Now, later on, he'll pitch a tent. They'll call the tent of meeting so that he could meet with God without always having to go up on the mountain. But he's gone up on the mountain, verse 3. In verse 4, he says, "This is what you say to the house of Jacob, to the children of Israel. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians. Remind them of the 10 plagues. Remind them of the death of the firstborn, and by implication, that your firstborn didn't die, of course." And he said, "I bore you on eagle's wings." You know, I suspect that the average Israelite tended to focus on the trip to Mount Sinai with, boy, we had to walk a long ways. You know, we encountered Amalekites who came out and attacked us. And we went hungry a few days. God said, I bore you on eagle's wings. I carried you through a desert that wouldn't sustain a nation like this. You know, I brought you here. But I want you to focus on something really important here. He said, I brought you to myself. I've not just delivered you from bondage. You're not just a people that were once enslaved and now free. I've brought you to myself. You know, God had told Moses long ago, you know, almost a year ago probably, that you're going to bring the people to Mount Sinai to worship. But he said, I've brought you to myself. And then he speaks of the covenant. When we think of a covenant, what do we think of usually? A contract. Somebody said an agreement. You know, there's this, it's two parties making some kind of agreement. Does Israel get to negotiate this contract, this covenant with God? Not by any means. In fact, in Deuteronomy, he will speak of how he commanded the covenant. Deuteronomy 4:13 is the verse. He said, I commanded my covenant. By the way, let me just sort of interrupt myself. The first few chapters of Deuteronomy really gives, it's the rehearsal, the repetition almost 40 years later of what's happened here. And there will be a few little details you'll pick up from the retelling of the story, much like, you know, conversion of Saul is given to us in three chapters. Every chapter has something in it that the others don't. You know, to get the fullest picture, you take all three chapters of Saul's conversion, which, by the way, they are Acts what? 9, 22, and 26. You didn't know you were going to get quizzed on Acts this morning. But you put it all together. Well, Deuteronomy gives some great extra details of things. But we'll save Deuteronomy for later primarily. This covenant is commanded. And it is a covenant that requires obedience. If you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, you know, you must do what I tell you. But, he says, if you do that, you will be my special people. There's going to be a relationship between us that is unique. All the earth is mine, he says. But you're going to be my special people, a special treasure to me above all people. The King James used the word, and then it's repeated in 1 Peter 2 in the King James, peculiar people. And 1611, peculiar, had the idea of special, unique. We've come to think of peculiar as weird, odd. And yes, sometimes people will look at the children of God and think they're weird because they don't do certain things. That was never the idea of it. It's that idea of just belonging unto God. And he said, you'll be that special people to me. You will be a kingdom of priests. You will have the privilege of approaching me in worship. And you will be a holy nation. Here's our word nation now. You're not just a family. You know, he didn't bring them out that they might disperse and just go their own way. He said, you're going to be a nation, as I promised Abraham. But you will be a holy nation. What does it mean to be holy? The what? set aside or set apart, pure, sanctified. You know, it's one of those, there are a lot of different ways, you know, to render it. The basic idea of something that was holy was something that is, as it were, pulled out of the ordinary and set apart to some special purpose. You know, think about, and it's not a perfect analogy, but in your house, you know, people used to, I don't know if they do as much anymore, but you had the fine china and you had the regular dishes. Well, you know, after we got dishwashers and people found out fine china couldn't go in the dishwasher, people quit having it. But, you know, you had ordinary dishes. Then you had special dishes. You know, the kids better not come in from playing and get in the china cabinet and get one of those dishes in which to eat and get one of the fine crystal glasses down and say, that's what I'm going to get my Kool-Aid in. No, those were for, they had special purpose. Well, the idea of holy is set apart from the ordinary and consecrated to a purpose. Let me give you a passage real quick. Leviticus chapter 20. Leviticus 20 and verse 26. Now, next quarter we'll be looking at Leviticus. And we will be emphasizing, you shall be holy for I am holy. Verse 26, he said, and you shall be holy to me, for I the Lord am holy, and have separated you from the peoples that you should be mine. I want you to catch the two things he says at the end. I separated you that you should be mine. You're not just, I didn't just deliver you from bondage. I didn't just pull you out of Egypt. You know, as he started it off, I brought you to myself. You're going to be my people. And again, I would remind you that several of these expressions are used of God's New Testament people. But going back here to Leviticus 19, that's what it kind of, the general principle. If you obey me, you'll be my special people. And Moses goes back down off the mountain. Verse 7, he called the elders of the people. He laid it out before them. And though we're not told directly that the elders went to the people, obviously they did. And what was the response of the people? Oh, we'll obey you. Everything that's been said, we will do. I wonder if Moses had any doubts at that point. Or if he was just excited. Oh, yeah, oh, great. Because it's not going to go so smoothly, is it? You know, in about 6 weeks, these same people that have said they're going to obey God and do everything he tells them are worshiping and dancing before a golden calf. You know, so, but right now they said they would obey. And then, what does the Lord do? Well, Moses, verse 8, he goes back up the mountain to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, I come to you in the thick cloud that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever. And then the Lord says to Moses, get the folks ready. They've got to get ready for my appearance. I'm coming down on the third day. Be prepared. And they were to wash their clothes. They were to be clean. They were to abstain from sexual relations with their wives. Not that this is a vulgar thing, but these next couple of days, the focus is on God is coming. God's already there in one sense. He's always there. But there's going to be something special on the third day. And he said, you put a boundary around this mountain. You mark it off. Who was allowed to cross the boundary? No one except for, of course, Moses. But if a man crossed the boundary, what was supposed to happen to him? Die. And they would shoot him with an arrow or stone him. You know, you don't even go chasing him down. And you don't allow animals to cross it. God is saying, y'all get ready for this. This is going to be something unique. And there are just a lot of folks whose image of the next chapter or so are shaped more by Hollywood and Charlton Heston than by the actual biblical account. You know, Charlton Heston goes up on the mountain and eventually he comes back down with these tablets, and that's their first record of the Ten Commandments. No, they're going to hear this first. But before they hear it, on the third day, look at how the mountain is described. It came to pass on the third day, this is verse 16, in the morning, that there were thunderings and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. Verse 13 had used the word trumpet. In the New American Standard, it says ram's horn. You know, they made trumpets out of metal. They also commonly used the horns that were made from the ram. And this is that word. I've never blown a ram horn. I have blown one made from cow horns. Some of you probably remember when those were not uncommon. A lot of the hunters would have horns. They'd take the cow horn, you know, cut each end off and blow it. I could imitate that sound, but y'all get the picture without it, right? But it gets louder, and the people are trembling. In verse 19, and the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder. And Moses spoke and God answered him. So the way it's describing, verse 20, the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on top of the mountain. And he calls Moses up onto the mountain again. And he says to Moses, go back down and warn the people. And tell them, don't be tempted to come up here and try to see what this is all about. I am a holy God and you keep your distance. Moses said, well, they've already been warned and we put up a boundary. God said, go tell them anyway. Picture Mount Sinai. I mean, you need to see this in your mind. This great cloud that comes down. And see that lightning coming and the clap of thunder over and over again. And the mountain actually quaking, and hear that trumpet as it just gets louder and louder and the noise. And the people are trembling in fear. And then remember what he says in Hebrews 12. We've come to a greater mountain than that. When we've come to the spiritual Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, that's a greater mountain, this Mount Zion that we have come to. So get this picture. And in the midst of all of this, the Lord said to Moses, you go down, only Aaron can come up with you. And when chapter 20 begins, this is not Moses up on the mountain getting the tablets of stone. Out of this great scene that we are picturing, suddenly they hear, I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Jehovah, the Lord, speaks in a voice they hear. And then he begins to give them what we have come to call the Ten Commandments. It's interesting to me. And I always say, what interests me doesn't always interest others. But the expression in the Hebrew repeatedly is the 10 words. You know, he will use at times the word commandment. He'll say, keep my commandments. Deuteronomy 4:13, I commanded my covenant. But he called them the 10 words. These form the basis. They are much like the Constitution of the United States. You know, we have tons and tons of laws. You know, I can't imagine how big the federal law code is these days. But it's all supposed to be based on and consistent with the Constitution. Y'all notice I said supposed to. But, you know, in a sense, this is like their Constitution. I know it's not the exact same, because it doesn't set up the government. But this is the basic code of their relationship to God and to one another. And God begins to speak. And he's going to, he'll develop it later on. Approximately 600 commandments are found in the Old Testament. But these are the foundation. And the very first thing is, you're to have no other gods before me, along with me. It is just going to be me. You know, this is an issue that we will see Israel struggle with. Throughout their history, they were a people who worshiped the Lord. Yahweh was their God, along with Baal and Asherah and others. You know, in the time, you remember on Mount Carmel, how long do you limp between two sides? When they worshiped Baal, they weren't saying, well, we have nothing to do with the Lord at all. At least the majority of people. But they want the Lord to be part of their pantheon of gods at times in their history. I mean, they've come out of a culture that just had multiple gods, the Egyptian culture. He said, no other gods. And then he said, no carved images, no idols. You know, that there is just something about human nature that we want to do a couple of things. We want to be able to visualize and localize. You know, we want to get our God down here where we can see him and where he's lacking the faith to trust him. And of course, what you see throughout history is Genesis opened up by saying God made man in his image. And since that time, men have sought to make gods in their image. You know, we want a God that gives us fertility. And we worship him with the temple prostitutes. You know, we want a God that gives us a great harvest. So we celebrate him with drunkenness. You know, these are the things we would see of old. Today, you know, we don't make the same kind of idols and images. But how many people make God to be like them? To just accept whatever they want? You know, we are no different as a culture. And culture impacts us if we're not careful. Look at verse 5. I wanted to comment on something there. He said, you're not to bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. The Lord will say that the child is not punished for the sins of the father. Well, then what about this? And I think the idea here is And especially what you see, the next thing he says, and showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. Your father was an idolater. And that's the reason you're an idolater. Your grandfather was an idolater. He said, that's not going to be an excuse for you. God said, I am such a jealous God, it will not matter if generation after generation, down to the fourth generation, if they reject me, they won't be excused because what they didn't know better. They will be held accountable. But notice, he says to the third and fourth generations there, but when it comes to mercy, he said to thousands. What does he prefer? He prefers generation after generation that are taught to love him and to obey him. And he will love them and he will be merciful to them. No idols. Do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. You know, this may have, the primary intent originally may have been involved in the taking of oaths. But whatever the purpose, you treat God with reverence. And you remember his Sabbath day to keep it holy. The word Sabbath meant a stoppage. That's the root idea. You cease, you stop. He gave them the Sabbath, and I think it becomes clear there's a twofold purpose. Man needs a day of rest. You know, I mean, you think about an agrarian society in which you worked from, you know, you probably ate your breakfast before the sun was up so that you could be in the field when there was enough light to see it. And you might work until dark. Then you had to go home and take care of your animals. And but he said, you stop and you rest. But you also, you keep it holy. Elsewhere we will read, it was a day of convocation, of gathering together to worship. It was to make it special. You know, we don't have a commanded Sabbath. What God teaches us on Sunday is very different, and yet I think there is a principle, not of necessarily the resting, but of making sure that the Sabbath was a day to rest and to contemplate God. That there's just not enough of that. Of this stopping to think of God and what he's done. Honor your father and mother. You know, that's so important that they would do these things. They would take care of them. He said, you shall not murder. Well, obviously, man is made in God's image. He said, you shall not commit adultery. This is primarily a protection of marriage. He will give other laws against other sexual misconduct later on. But this one is a protection of the sanctity of marriage. He said, you shall not steal. Leviticus and Numbers, they'll add various things. You know, you don't move your neighbor's boundary marker. Well, that's stealing. You know, but, you know, here's just the general principle. You respect the life, the marriage, the property of another. You don't bear false witness against your neighbor. Think about verse 17 and what it does. Verse 17 gets to the heart. We sometimes think or told the Old Testament was so much more material in nature, fleshly, the New Testament spiritual. And there is, God was dealing with a physical nation. You know, and there is some of that. But here in the last commandment, he really addresses the heart of sin. The heart of sin, by getting to the heart. Why do people commit adultery? Well, they first coveted their neighbor's wife. Why do they steal? Well, because they first coveted their neighbor's things. He said, I want more than just the fact that you don't steal or that you don't commit adultery or murder or whatever. He said, I don't want you to be covetous. I want you to control your heart in this. He lays out these 10 words, these 10 commandments. And how do the people respond? What's their reaction? They said, well, I want you to look at 18 through 21. When he speaks these 10 words, it terrified them. The people, it said, they trembled. They stood afar off. They said to Moses, you speak with us and we will hear, but let not God speak with us lest we die. And Moses said, do not fear. Now watch this, this is really interesting. Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that has fear may be before you, so that you may not sin. Don't be afraid, yet God came down to make you afraid. You know, don't be so afraid that you are going to run and hide under the bushes. And yet, God wants a spirit of reverential fear. He wants you to understand that He is a mighty God. Why does He appear with thunder and lightning and a quaking mountain and a trumpet sound that just... He wanted them to understand. We might say, Dave, I'm not kidding around here. He said, we're serious. You will be my special people. You'll be a special treasure to me. But I've got some words for you. You know, not suggestions, you know, of, you know, well, if you want to have a good life, these things will help you along the way. He said, this is what I expect of you. And then in verse 22 through 26, I'll just say it this way. You've got a temporary teaching. He gives them some instruction about the altar. It'll be replaced in a short time by the altar of burnt offerings, but nevertheless. Okay, Wednesday night, finish this lesson. We will not move to lesson 11, but we will review chapter 20 and cover 21 through 24 for Wednesday night.